In the late 1960s, between high school and college, I spent a summer working in Appalachia in a desperately poor little town, a collection of shacks, really, in West Virginia. I remember visiting a family and seeing that they had almost no food, several hungry children, and no obvious means of support. It was shocking to see that level of deprivation in our country. Government programs in the 1960s and 70s cut the poverty rate and reduced the number of hungry people in this country, but the problem of hunger still persists. Today, with a downturn in the economy, more families are turning to the government and lining up at soup kitchens and food pantries to feed themselves and their families. My guest, Joel Berg, heads up the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, and he's got a new book called All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. He worked for the USDA for 8 years and was coordinator of community food security, and he joins us today on Radio Times to talk about how to solve the problem of hunger in the United States. And Joel Berg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. I noticed that people like you and others talk about hunger. They talk about food insecurity. And the word seems to be food insecurity these days, not so much hunger. Nonetheless, I don't want to get caught up in a semantic battle back and forth. But what do you mean by food insecurity?
Food insecurity is a horrible term. It's academic. It's wonkish. My mother, I could never explain to her what it meant. That being said, it's still the best way to really explain what hunger is in America. It's not children starving in the streets, like Somalia or North Korea or parts of Latin America. We used to have things like that, but we don't anymore, by and large, because we do have Federal Nutrition Assistance Safety Net, although it's too small, as we'll talk about. What it is people choosing between food and rent. People choosing between food and health care. Food insecurity means people having to ration food or worry about having enough food. I talk about in my book, it's cancer patients in Kentucky who can't afford cancer medicine and food. And I'm sure we'll talk about more. It's the greatest irony of all. It's people who, because they can't afford the most nutritious food, which is the most expensive, buy less nutritious food, more filling food, which often contributes to their obesity. And so it's not starvation, but it is an unacceptable level of rationing food that in a country that last year had 400 billionaires, I think most Americans agree is absolutely unacceptable.
Well, in Philadelphia, I'm sure it's true in New York where you live and work, in many poor communities, you're not going to find a grocery store. You're going to find a corner store, and there's nothing wrong with that. But nonetheless, if you're going to buy nutritious food for your children, chances are it's a pretty limited choice at a corner store.
Absolutely. Low-income people face two food challenges. The first, as you just said, is there are large swaths of Philadelphia, large swaths of urban and rural America, even some parts of suburban America these days, where you can't get fresh produce. You can't even buy whole wheat bread. And if you could find those, they're generally more expensive. Whole milk is cheaper than skim milk. White bread is cheaper than whole bread. Fatty meat is cheaper than lean meat. So even if this stuff physically exists in your neighborhood, in many neighborhoods it doesn't, despite the great work of places like the Food Trust that have really tried to turn that around, it's still far too many neighborhoods in Pennsylvania don't have fresh food or southern New Jersey. But if it is there, you just can't afford it.
We talk about divides in this country, and there really is a food divide because on the one hand, people with money, and you don't have to have a lot of money, but nonetheless, people that have a secure income can spend a fair amount of money on some of these more high-end, probably more nutritious items. People at the low end who are this food insecure, as you say, have so much less choice, less healthy choice.
Absolutely. I spent a week living on a food stamps diet of $28.30 for a week. I could barely survive on that. That's a little over a dollar a meal, and that was in New York City, and that was before food prices really spiked 2 years ago and was nearly impossible to do. But the greatest revelation for me was just the lack of choice. Mm. Choices were made for me. And I also noticed that as a white-collar worker, I would go to breakfasts for work where there was free food. I would go to lunch for work, where their lunch meetings would free food. I would go to fundraising receptions or awards receptions after work, where the shrimp cocktails flowed almost as freely as the cocktails. So in the great irony of it that, you know, Hollywood stars who get swag bags of these expensive items that need at least those of us in society who least need free food get it all the time. And yet, for low-income people, we've set up these incredibly punitive systems to get even basic help through the food stamps program or other programs for even working families to be able to feed their children. It really is a tremendous double standard in the society.
Help us understand, though, the connection between obesity and food insecurity.
You know, conservatives have made a very specific attempt over the last few years to con America into believing that hunger doesn't exist because we have obesity. That's preposterous. There are very, very complex contributors to people weighing too much. Since this is radio, I could tell your listeners I'm really, really thin, but it's not just true. I have a slight pot belly on me, even though I try to run. I ran the New York City Marathon a few years ago. But there are complex reasons why people weigh a little too much. There's genetics, there's cultural reasons, there's certainly free choice, because I've been so busy on the book tour, I've actually gained weight because I've had less time to exercise and less choice in fast food restaurants when I'm on the road eating. That being said, there is no doubt that hunger, food insecurity, and poverty are significant contributors to the obesity problem. We know that when people are very, very hungry, and there still are some Americans who really come at least somewhat close to the third world style definition of hungry, some homeless people, some other people, if you really miss significant numbers of meals, there is plenty of data showing that you will actually lose weight. But far more commonplace in America, again, is this broader idea of food security or food insecurity, people choosing between food, people rationing food. We heard a story yesterday from a woman in Philadelphia with the Witnesses Against Hunger program that said sometimes she goes without food to lend food to her neighbors. And when that happens, a bag of potato chips is often more physically accessible and more economically affordable than a basket of fresh produce. And so that bag of potato chips is going to fill your stomach, meet your immediate hunger cravings, but unfortunately, in the long term, make you more obese, even though you may suffer from lack of affordable food.
And I'm thinking even of fast food, which of course is relatively cheap, has a lot of salt, has a lot of sugar, has a kind of taste that make you feel like you're filled up and also full of calories on top of that.
Yeah. Where I work in the Wall Street neighborhood of Manhattan, there's a Burger King two doors down from my organization. And first of all, it's a great irony that the medium-sized meal is cheaper than the smaller portions. So I have to go through this whole big deal.
And medium is usually giant size.
Right. In most other countries, medium would be considered giant. So I want the small because actually, people don't realize it's not necessarily the burger that's the biggest calories. It's the fries and the soda, which are the calories. And I have to argue with them to get the smaller portions with the smaller price. But even with the bigger price, it is still many dollars cheaper to get a value meal at the Burger King rather than a salad two doors down at a deli on my block, which is about almost $10 for a salad. And that's about an hour and a half of minimum wage work to earn that salad. And I'm lucky to live in a Wall Street, you know, work in the Wall Street area where there are stockbrokers who will pay $10 a salad, and I will when I need to if I can't bring food from home, which is hard to do when I have so many meetings. So people don't believe it. You know, it's so-called counterintuitive to say we can have hunger and obesity. It just sounds right. That goodness, we can't have hunger if we have all these fat people. Mm. But when you look at the data, I've presented BOKU data, lots of scientific medical studies. The facts are clear that obesity and hunger are often flip sides of the same malnutrition coin.
You say if this country were to spend something like $24 billion a year, we could actually and the kind of food insecurity, the kind of hunger we've been talking about. How would that work?
Absolutely. And when I started researching this a few years ago and came up with the $24 billion number, people said, oh, Joel, that's crazy talk. That's just too much money. We could never afford it. And I make two points. Number one, this country loses $90 billion a year because we have hunger. Lost wages because hungry workers are less productive, lost educational performance because food insecure children don't learn as well, and increased educational spending. Second point, $24 billion, as vast as it is, that was about 2% of the Wall Street bailout. If we could afford hundreds of billions of dollars for Wall Street fat cats, billions and billions of dollars to bail out the big three automakers for their failures, we can certainly ensure that America, the richest country in the history of the world, ensures that kids don't have to go through dumpsters in the back of the school to get breakfast, as I heard a school official in New York say. So I've presented a pretty basic plan. Raise wages for workers, and that wouldn't cost the government a dime. I'm asking business executives, particularly the wealthiest ones, to voluntarily say, instead of having seven vacation homes and paying my workers so little they can't feed their families, maybe I'll only have five vacation homes and use the savings to make sure all my workers can buy food. Two, a reformed, modernized, but funded nutrition assistance safety net. With less paperwork, less bureaucracy, less treating poor people as criminals just because they need food to feed their families. And third, an up-to-date school meals program, particularly in-class universal school breakfast. And I actually attended a press conference this morning with Mayor Nutter, who was calling on the federal government to restore Philadelphia's ability to provide universal school meals with less paperwork. And that's something the federal government could do very rapidly, and we're hopeful that the Obama administration will.
And just picking up on one of those, and I'm looking at our clock here, a school lunch program, you're saying make it free for all children?
Absolutely.
And not just for the kids who are poor and need to be subsidized.
That is
so
correct.
Speak.
And that sounds like a liberal position, but it's actually a conservative position. At the federal level, at the state level, at the city level, at the school district level, all throughout America, we have developed massive bureaucracies to collect forms to determine whether kids pay full price for lunch, pay reduced price for lunch, or pay nothing for lunch. Same for breakfast. We could dramatically reduce that bureaucracy, dramatically reduce that government paperwork, which conservatives hate and I hate, and pump that money back into feeding hungry children. Even a very conservative senator from Mississippi, Thad Cochran, told a hunger conference a few years ago he thought doing that would save the government money. It's just common sense.
And the other thing you say is really streamlining government programs built around food stamp program?
Yes. I mean,
is that the kind of cornerstone, the corner piece of a food insecurity program?
Well, the food stamps program dwarfs all other federal programs, but you need a different application. You need to go to a different office, sometimes taking a day or two or three off work to get food stamps. Then you have to go to a different government office on a different day to get WIC program if you're eligible. Women, infants, and children provides children under age of five and pregnant women specially designed nutrition help. School meals, you have to fill out a different application sent to a different office. I've proposed combining all those programs, reducing the administrative overhead, still having the distinct benefits, but allowing people to apply online or in person at offices with one simple application. Again, reducing paperwork, reducing bureaucracy, helping feed hungry kids, liberal and conservative.
Let me take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Joel Berge. He heads up the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. He's got a new book called All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. We're talking about dealing with hunger today on Radio Times, and we've got a guest waiting in the wings, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and presents Twyla Tharp's Nine Sinatra Songs at the Marion Theater now through the 15th. This program includes Peter Martins's Fearful Symmetries, the world premiere of Requiem for a Rose by Annabelle Lopez Ochoa, and Twyla Tharp's ballroom-style dancing to Frank Sinatra hits like My Way and Strangers in the Night. For tickets, 215-336-2000 or paballet.org.
Hi, this is Bill Morazzo, president of WHYY. As you know by now, this past Sunday, in fact, at 9:01 a.m., our winter member drive reached and then exceeded its goals. More than 7,000 of you took the time to make a pledge of support. Your participation tells us that you value being part of a community of listeners that care about being informed in this ever-changing world of ours. So at a time when we all need to prioritize, we are honored that you consider WHYY as your most trusted source for news and information.
Tune into the topics that have Black America talking.
You guys can move so quickly to bail out Wall Street. How come we don't move that fast when it's me and you?
We'll be footing all of the bill while corporate interests get all of the bailout.
You have to make sure they don't do it again.
I'm Tony Cox. What's the latest word from the web? Our bloggers roundtable will tell you next time on News and Notes.
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY. In Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. An estimated 35 million Americans, including some 12 million children, are described as food insecure. That's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joel Berg, our guest for this hour of Radio Times, executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, and he's written a new book called All You Can Eat, How Hungry is America. And joining us now is Carrie Morgan. She's director of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger, whose education and advocacy programs educate citizens and help to shape public policy. Carrie Morgan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Now, we know that Philadelphia's rate of poverty, and this is before the recession hit, was about 25%. Would you say that Philadelphians are more insecure today than they were, a year ago?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even in the food stamp enrollment numbers, we're seeing unprecedented growth. From December last year to December this year, we've seen approximately 7% more people enrolling in the food stamp program. From the previous year, it's about 17%. So we know that there is an unprecedented need, and that need keeps growing daily, but we know that there's a context of diminishing resources. Food isn't being donated to the food banks. Food pantries are having trouble meeting the demand. And it's a growing problem within the context of a downturn in the economy.
And are these families that are either losing their jobs or have been on the sort of margins between poverty and being working poor, so to speak?
Exactly. We are seeing so many more families who maybe last year were able to make ends meet. They may have just been on the line, but they were putting food on the table. This year, they just can't do it. And as Joel was saying, they're having to make really difficult choices. And how do you decide between paying your rent and putting food on the table, getting medicine or putting food on the table? It's an impossible choice, and it's not one that should have to be made at all.
And you're saying that food pantries, soup kitchens are under stress? I mean, that they're having, a hard time finding the food for the people?
They are absolutely under stress. We did a survey this past fall, and what we found is that about 50% of the food pantries in Philadelphia aren't able to meet their current demand, and it's gotten so bad that about 43% of them have actually had to turn people away. And a lot of that has been instigated by cuts in funding, for example, the State Food Purchase Program, which is the vehicle through which a lot of the food pantries get their food, was cut a couple of years ago, and the funding hasn't been reinstated, yet the cost of food has gone up so much. So we see this cost of food going up, we see demand going up, but there just aren't the resources to fill that demand.
Let me get you back in on the conversation, Joel Berg, because you do talk about soup kitchens and food pantries as really not the solution to the problem of hunger or food insecurity.
Absolutely. In New York City, our numbers are even worse. Our survey found last year two-thirds of the pantries, what you call cupboards here in Philadelphia, or kitchens, had to ration food by turning people away, reducing portion size, or reducing the hours of operation. Trying to solve a massive national problem with an underfunded, undercoordinated, understaffed volunteer system is absurd. Trying to end hunger with a few more canned food drives is like trying to fill the Grand Canyon with a teaspoon. When we have a major national problem, government has to be involved. If the Ben Franklin Bridge, I always try to get in those Philly references, if the Ben Franklin Bridge fell down tomorrow, we wouldn't say, oh, let's have a church bake sale to try to raise the money to fix it. We'd understand there's a vested national interest in getting people and goods in between New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and the federal government would take the lead. When we have a major national interest in helping our economy, helping school performance, we understand that it's government that's got to take the lead, and the federal government's got to take the lead. When the federal government did take the lead in the 60s and 70s, as you pointed out, hunger dramatically went down. We know it can work again because it worked in the past.
But are you saying that soup kitchens, food pantries actually prevent the government from doing what you think they should be doing?
I am not. there are some people on the left who have made the argument that pantries and kitchens, if they somehow went away, the people would rise up and demand social justice. I think the more logical conclusion based on history, if pantries and kitchens and cupboards went away, poor people would just suffer more. So in the interim, we definitely need them. They should be well-funded. I hope the governor and the legislature do fully fund the feeding program. But let us not mistake that for the best long-term response, which is living wage jobs for everyone who is able to work, and for those for whom wages isn't enough or can't work, a serious safety net that doesn't treat you like a criminal to get, doesn't waste a lot of taxpayers' money on a big bureaucracy, and spends the money in America, because spending on food stamps is one of the best economic recovery ways we have. People who shop at stores locally put money into the local economy. When a wealthy person gets a tax cut, they may or may not buy something like a yacht, which may or may not be built in America. When a poor person buys food, the food more likely than not was grown in America, processed in America, shipped in America, warehoused in America, and sold in America, creating American jobs. Food spending from the government is one of the smartest economic strategies we can take, no matter your ideology.
Carrie Morgan, let me go back to you, because your organization is the Greater Philadelphia Coalition. We focus largely on the city. Obviously, that's where most of the poor people are. But nonetheless, I want our listeners to understand what might be happening in the suburbs or even some of the more rural areas around Philadelphia.
Well, I think, you know, Philadelphia has generational poverty. It's been around a long time. People are used to hearing about it. But as we were saying, there are more working families that are now falling through the safety net into poverty, and many of those are living in the suburbs. And we are seeing a lot more people coming into the suburbs to go to shelters, to go to the kitchens, to go to the pantries. And we are seeing a lot more interest in terms of enrolling in food stamp program from people in the suburbs. And it's hard to put numbers to that, but we estimate from in the greater Philadelphia area that about 300,000 households are living in insecure, food insecure environment right now.
That's a lot of households.
Yeah.
And we're going to be talking in about 10 minutes or so with Republican state legislator, state senator, actually, about a hunger caucus that's being started in the legislature. Carrie Morgan, do you see this as a positive sign?
Oh, it's absolutely positive. And it's an absolute necessity. And I think, you know, there's definitely momentum building around an anti-hunger movement. I think it's one of the most astonishing facts is that we have a president who is actually on food stamps as a child, and that kind of changes the conversation around it. And I think what we're going to need is collaboration and initiative on the part of the federal government, the state government, and the local governments. We are so excited, anti-hunger advocates are so excited that there is interest in building a task force around hunger in Pennsylvania. And there's also a mayor's task force on hunger developing. And it's going to take that kind of collaboration between government agencies, nonprofit agencies, corporations, and individuals in order to solve this problem.
Carrie Morgan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's director of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger. And staying with us for the rest of the hour, Joel Berg, executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. And he's the author of a new book. It's called All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. He served for a number of years in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and actually from 1999 to 2001 acted as coordinator of community food security. And that's our topic for today's Radio Times. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joel, let's get some callers in on the conversation. And we've got Vincent calling us from Center City, Philadelphia. Vincent, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I want to just say that there are actually a lot of cheap ways to get fresh produce. And I think it's more people's choice who are choosing the bad diets. Okay, like, for example, there is a food truck near 44th and Warnock Street. I live in Center City, Philadelphia. They sell fresh produce for under a dollar for a head of lettuce, for, like, five oranges, and which is cheaper than fries. And there are also grocery stores such as Aldi at 46th and Market that they have frozen vegetables for a pound of frozen vegetable for a dollar, and also cheap fresh groceries there. And it's just people not choosing the right fit. I mean, even people who are on a budget can readily afford those groceries. I think we're pretty lucky for that. And I think it's more a culture thing than what your guest is suggesting, that people don't have access and products are not available.
Okay, fair enough. Vincent, he's saying to you, Joel Berg, that it's more of a cultural problem, and he uses an example of a food cart that's in West Philadelphia with fresh veggies.
There's exception to every rule, and I obviously haven't spent as much time in Philadelphia as I do in New York, but I've spent enough time in Philadelphia over the years to know that there are still large swaths of this city where you cannot get the products this gentleman just suggested. I was in Pittsburgh a few months ago, spent a week in the Hill District of Pittsburgh, a historically African-American low-income neighborhood. You had to drive 15 minutes to find any even relatively healthy food. And by the way, that's assuming you have a car. Anyone who's ever shopped and then tried to get on a bus or a subway knows that is not an easy proposition. And if you have spent all your money on vegetables, what do you have left for everything else? Mm-hmm. I will say this. I hear this kind of claim a lot, and my work in New York shows it's just not true. When we make fresh produce physically available and economically affordable, people come and get it and eat it up and line up sometimes for a long time to get it. We have a project in New York where we give out fresh produce from small farms through pantries and kitchens, and also allow people to use food stamps benefits or scholarship levels to get this food, and there are long lines. In New York, when we increased the ability of people to use food stamps at farmers markets, people lined up to use the food stamps at farmers markets for fresh produce. So I truly believe it is an issue of access. Doesn't mean there isn't someone who isn't going to buy vegetables, but we also have to look at the time considerations. We've said low-income people should work. They shouldn't be on welfare. Today in America, only 10% of all the people in poverty are on welfare. That means the vast majority of people are working one, two, three jobs, raising their kids without the benefit of an upper-class nanny, and the amount of time they have left over to cook beans from scratch or to prepare produce from scratch is pretty limited. So not only do they have less money, they have less time.
Vincent, thanks for the call to Radio Times. In Philadelphia, there are community gardens all across the city. I'm sure in New York there are as well. Is this another way to thinking of trying to get produce to people, fresh produce to people, or is it just too small scale to make a difference?
Community gardens can certainly help, and Philadelphia is renowned throughout the country for its wonderful system of community gardens. Unfortunately, Mayor Giuliani in New York dramatically reduced the number of community gardens, basically giving away land to developers, some of which never became housing. But I stress, Philadelphia is not that much further south than New York. I happen to like eating 12 months out of the year. The truth of the matter is, in the mid-Atlantic states, there's only a few months growing period. And as we have more need for affordable housing, there'll be less and less open land. So sure, we can do creative things on vacant lots. Sure, we can do creative things with school gardens and rooftop gardens. But I do challenge the Michael Pollans and the Alice Waters of the world, sort of the elite foodies, who give the impression that if low-income people just wanted, they could grow their own food, just drive down to the garden centers, Michael Pollans says, and get your gardening supplies. Well, many inner cities don't have gardening centers. Low-income people don't have the cars to do them, don't have the money or the time to do it. So I am very supportive of community gardens. My organization supports them. We should expand them, but I hope no one believes they are a serious replacement for living wage jobs and a nutrition assistance safety net.
Let me get Stephen from the Northeast to join us. Stephen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I was a health inspector in 1996 for the summer. You can get hired sort of temporarily when you're in college to inspect summer feeding sites. So anyone who participates, like a playground or people's houses, you go around and you make sure that they're getting food. They get food from the city. They get milk and sandwiches, and you inspect the homes. And there was a tremendous amount of waste. Like, the kids never wanted to drink the white milk. You know, they all wanted the chocolate milk. So you'd come back maybe at the end of the day, and you'd be throwing away bags and bags of sandwiches, maybe because they didn't like the sandwiches. They would eat these little sticky buns, and the chocolate milk. But none of them wanted to do the white milk or the sandwiches. So, I mean, Are there any studies on how much of this food that's given away for free? Like, and I also saw it as a high school teacher. Kids would like throw yogurt at each other and apples and oranges. Are there any studies that have tracked how much food is wasted?
Well, you raise several different points. Let me get a response from our guest, Joel Berg. Thanks, Steve.
There have been some studies. I suspect what most of them have concluded, I've read a number of them, that perhaps there's not quite as much waste nationwide as you indicate, but there certainly is waste. Part of the problem, honestly, are sort of the agribusiness politics of the school meals, that Congress and the law dictate a certain number of products, even if a child's lactose intolerant, even if they have other inclinations. The second problem is that as we're trying to make school meals more nutritious, and we want kids to eat more nutritiously, they also have what they're used to in the marketplace. And so we do have to find ways to make meals not only more nutritious, but more tasty for kids, because they are the ultimate marketplace of whether they're going to eat it or not. So I personally think we need a little more flexibility down the road in some of the federal standards mandating what certain sites have to have. But the other thing is, one of the things we did when I was at the U.S. Department of Agriculture is we clarified that extra food from these programs could be donated to groups like Philabundance. So assuming it's not served and assuming the milk isn't in the hot sun for too many hours, if it is still held safely, that extra food could and should be donated to feed hungry Philadelphians.
And Stephen's call raises, you touched on this, but just the idea that you can put nutritious food in front of people, but if they haven't been sort of educated about it or even had the kind of experience with it, right. You know, what do you do with a beet? As an example, right. Part of that is it seems to me is just educating people about what this food is about, because you know, salt and fat is really instantaneously rewarding as a taste.
All Americans need to eat more nutritiously. And I get a little wary in any discussion that gives the implication that low-income people are somehow uniquely poor eaters, or that the food stamps program somehow contributes to the problem, when in fact there are plenty of studies that show people on the food stamps program eat just as nutritiously or as poorly as other equally poor people. That being said, we definitely have a problem with nutrition education in our society. I always do a demonstration. If this was TV, I'd show you. I can't show you on radio, three different bags of pretzels, and they all look to be identical sizes to the naked eye. One claims to be three portions, one claims to be two portions, one claims to be one portions, and most Americans don't understand that if it's three portions and it says 150 calories per portion, that means that bag is 450 calories. So we all need better nutrition education, and that's one of the reasons I support community gardens and school gardens, not so much for the volume of the food produced, but it helps with nutrition education. When kids grow food, I've seen projects where kids make smoothies out of fruit. When they help prepare it with their own hands, it's a lot more likely they're going to develop the habits to eat it over time.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Joel Berg, Executive Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, and he's got a new book called All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. That's exactly what we're talking about today on Radio Times. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Rowan University College of Fine and Performing Arts in Glassboro, New Jersey supports WHYY and encourages listeners to sample their varied programming. Included are the 39th Annual Rowan Jazz Festival Closing Concert, February 13th at 8 p.m., and the art exhibit Double Bind, Women Telling It Slant, February 16th to March 20th. Details at 856-256-4545 or rowan.edu/FPA.
On the next Fresh Air, New York's Finest versus Al-Qaeda. Writer Christopher Dickey takes us inside the New York City Police Department's Counterterrorism Division, a unit that taps the language skills of the city's ethnically diverse police ranks and stations cops overseas to gather intelligence. Dickey's book is called Securing the City. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A community banker says he doesn't want bailout money. He wants jobs for his customers. Also, poorly designed body parts. Would an intelligent being have made an eyeball with a blind spot? That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about hunger in America with our guest, Joel Berg. And joining us now is Pennsylvania State Senator Mike Brubaker. He's a Republican from Lancaster County, co-chair and founder of the Legislative Hunger Caucus. And Senator Mike Brubaker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
It's a real privilege for me to be with you, and thank you for taking up this issue today.
Well, you're very welcome. We've been focusing on Philadelphia, frankly, the rest of the country. Let's focus a bit on Pennsylvania. When we talk about food insecurity and you're looking at the state of Pennsylvania, what percentage of the state do you think are or is food insecure?
Well, we actually have some pretty good numbers. It's approximately 490,000 families or 1.3 million people in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And the total population of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is 12.5 million.
So it's about 10%.
About 10%. So we're stunned. And the most stunning statistic of all is USDA has been tracking hunger and food insecurity since 1995. And food insecurity and hunger is now up 24% since 1995. So I and other members of the Pennsylvania General Assembly believe that taking action is certainly not an option. Not taking action is not an option.
What do you want the Pennsylvania legislature to do?
Well, myself and Representative John Myers of the House of Representatives in Philadelphia, we're co-chairing House and Senate, Republican and Democrats, so about bicameral effort and our number one goal, short term, is to make sure every one of the 253 members of the Pennsylvania General Assembly is fully informed on hunger and food insecurity issues. We really believe that once you become aware of how serious this problem is, that taking action is no longer optional. People will be moved to action once they become informed. So anyway, step one.
Well, let me just stop you there. But do you think that there are members of the legislature who don't know about people in their district who are food insecure?
Well, I'm confident every member of the Pennsylvania General Assembly understands that there are people that are going hungry. Mm-hmm. What I also have learned, because I was not aware, and I've learned that either most of the members are not aware of the dramatic increase in the numbers. Our food banks are reporting now a 50% increase in demand over a relatively short period of time, and their incoming supplies are relatively level. So this is a situation. Yes, people are aware of hungry people, mm-hmm, in the General Assembly. They were not aware of how quickly the problem is escalating. And then finally, some of my particular district is relatively affluent. I was talking with a constituent the other day who shared with me that he just got back from volunteering at his local food bank, and he was quite surprised at the types of vehicles that were driving up to ask for food. So we can't stereotype what is a hungry person or a hungry family. In some cases, these are people that had relative affluence 6-8 months ago and fell on some difficult times, and now they're in need of help.
And you are from the Lancaster area of Pennsylvania, just so our listeners know.
That's correct, and I'm also the chairman of the state's Agriculture Committee, and it's from that position that I know that we produce plenty of food in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to feed our people.
Well, I wanted to pick on that because people might not know this around Philadelphia, but Pennsylvania is a very, very agricultural state. There are a lot of farms. There's also processing in the state as well. How do you connect then these hungry people with the agriculture in Pennsylvania?
Well, it's really quite remarkable, the giving that's already taking place. So number one, I personally don't believe that government needs to be the 100% solution to this problem, that every single person listening to this radio program can take some form of action if they only know how to volunteer a few hours of their time, or if they only know where to write that check. And so we have an infrastructure in place that will allow people to volunteer their time and or write a check. And I would just ask your other guest and or the Philadelphia Network to communicate the the best places in the greater Philadelphia region to ask people to step forward and volunteer time and offer money. And of course, be cautious. Make sure if you're writing a check to someone, make sure that 80 or 90% of that check at least is going to help the hungry people, and a very small portion of that check goes to pay the overall overhead of these organizations.
So so that people know that money is well spent. Mike Brubaker, let me get Joel Berg back in on the conversation. He's the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. And his argument is that, yes, food pantries and making donations is all well and good, but it's really the responsibility of government, whether it's local, state, or federal, to deal with the problem of hunger in America. Let me give him a chance to say it in his own words, and I'll get a response from you.
I would like that.
Yes.
And I'm always crystal clear. I don't think government should do it alone. The private sector has an important role, first and foremost, not just in donating food, but paying their workers enough to feed their families. I run a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We depend on volunteers. We depend on donations. There are absolutely stellar organizations in Philadelphia, like Philabundance, the Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger. Both are excellent organizations with national reputations. But in my book, I actually calculated methodically what would happen if we actually doubled charitable food distribution in America. And that would be a 200% increase, and yet we'd be lucky in this economy to get a 10% increase. But let's say we got a 200% increase. That would only move the number of Americans who are hungry from about 36 million to about 32 million. I compare that, however, to increasing the Federal Nutrition Assistance Safety Net by only 41%, and that would entirely end food insecurity in America. So the argument I would make: civil society has to play a role. The private sector has to play a role, particularly in job creation. But if we have a massive problem that outstrips the ability of charities to deal with it, then the logical conclusion is that the fullest representation of community is government. And in fact, no one really elected me or any other nonprofit leader. People did elect the Pennsylvania legislature. So I would actually argue that elected officials have more legitimacy from a philosophical perspective than little nonprofits do.
Senator Brubaker, let me get a response from you. Then we're going to have to say goodbye and get some callers back in on the conversation. But what do you say as a philosophical, political idea?
Well, I'm not sure that Joel's position and mine is all that different. I did hear him say that he and I both agree that we need to have government and private sector and corporations all working cooperatively together. Now, the only question is, you know, who moves the greatest distance? There's no doubt our challenge right here in Pennsylvania state government is a major statewide and nationwide and global recession. So we have major cuts to essentially all of our spending lines, and there's a few exceptions. And one of those exceptions, I'm proud to say, is our state food purchase program actually did increase in the governor's initial budget proposal. It did not double, but it did increase. So we in the General Assembly are evaluating that very closely, and we're going to work as hard as we can to put additional dollars back in. And if I may offer my phone number, I'd like to do that if
Please
anybody
do.
Would like to contact me directly.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Thank you. It's 717-917-8541, and that's a personal cell phone number.
Wow. You're brave.
Well, I want to hear from people, and we want to channel people's collective efforts into actually making a difference. Joel's right. People out there need help. And if I've heard it one time, I've heard it 100 times. Some people out there listening will have the misperception that these people just don't want to work. These people have led themselves into a condition where they have become dependent on government. Well, you know, get to know people that are hungry, and you're going to understand that in many cases life has just dealt them an unexpected blow. And we all need to be respectful of people that are in a down cycle, downturn in their life, and we need to do all we can to do collectively, government, corporations, and individuals.
I thank you very much for joining us at AM Radio Times. Thank you very much, Senator Brubaker.
My privilege. Thank you.
And you're very welcome. That's Pennsylvania State Senator Mike Brubaker. He's a Republican from Lancaster County and the third of three guests joining us today on Radio Times. Joel Berg staying with us for the rest of the hour. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joel, did you want to say something just in response?
I just want to say I'm thrilled that such a senior member of the legislature has really taken up this cause. And the fact that he is on the Agriculture Committee, a leader of that committee, cannot be understated, the importance of that. We cannot feed hungry people without farmers. Consumers need farmers. Farmers need consumers. So it's definitely going to take the agricultural sector to be part of this response.
And he's a Republican. I mean, I'm sure some people look at this as a liberal issue, a conservative issue, a Republican issue, a Democratic issue. Just how divided do you think people are on this issue of hunger, Joel?
It doesn't need to be divided. The biggest progress we had over the 1970s was when Senator Bob Dole, a very conservative senator from Kansas, teamed up with Senator George McGovern, a very liberal, a senator from South Dakota, and they made real progress creating the modern federal nutrition assistance safety. That being said, I run a nonpartisan organization that is nonpartisan by law, and I'm very careful not to align with any political party. That being said, the reality is even hunger heroes like George McGovern, when Reagan proposed a budget to slash food stamps, he voted for it. When Gingrich came into power and sort of forced his hand as Senate Majority Leader, he supported very large cuts in hunger programs. And the truth is many so-called moderates have voted for budget resolutions that have slashed hunger programs. So on one hand, I am going to be extraordinarily praiseworthy for anyone of any party, any ideology, who speaks out on the need to end hunger. On the other hand, I do think, and I'm critical in my book, of hunger groups are sort of patsies who will stand with elected officials and everyone will say the easy thing, we're against hunger, and then they'll turn around and cut to slash taxes on the rich and save money to do that by slashing hunger programs for working poor people. So I think we should be broad and expansive and reach out, but also hold people accountable for their actual actions.
Let me just say, add one thing to that, because you have a page here which I circled, how conservatives and liberals see welfare and poverty. And there's a whole long list. I'll just do the top two, or the top on each side. Conservatives punish and scapegoat the poor. Liberals patronize and glamorize the poor.
Absolutely. I think one thing people will be surprised when they read my book, it is not just a left-wing screech. I take liberals to task for maybe marginally doing more or marginally opposing cuts, but really, liberals, by and large in America, have not supported large-scale new efforts to help people not just stay in poverty, marginally less miserable, but to really move out of poverty. So I call for a whole new way of thinking about social welfare policy, what I call aspirations empowerment agenda, not just to help people stay in poverty, but to help people move from owing to owning, to help them earn, learn, and save their way out of poverty. I know there are a lot of conservatives in the Philadelphia area who don't want to throw more money at programs, even if they've worked. I think this is an agenda that all Americans, regardless of ideology, can really unite around. The basic idea that if you're working hard and playing by the rules, as my old boss Bill Clinton used to say, you ought to be able to support your family.
Let me get a couple of callers on before we have to say goodbye. We have Sidel from Conshohocken joining us. Hi, Sidel. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning.
There's no doubt that the food stamp program is the most efficient way to deal with hunger across the country. And we also know that it is one of the most effective and efficient stimulus tools. And I'd like to hear a few words from you about what's happening in Washington, both in the Senate bill and the House bill that have included food stamp program boosts, as well as additional funding for TFAP, which would put food into our nation's cupboards. And I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
Yeah, Sidel, thanks for calling in to Radio Times. And we should say there are differences in the House and the Senate bill. The job down in the Senate is to try to reconcile these differences. But Joel, nonetheless, as it stands today, what do you see?
Well, only once in a blue moon will a really hard-charging advocate such as myself praise government. But I'm willing to say this is that blue moon. The House version, particularly the House version of the recovery bill, is a very substantial advance. You know, we fought for a long time to get a farm bill to increase food stamps benefits, and that provided about $10 billion over 10 years, about $1 billion a year for increased nutrition benefits. The House version of the bill provides $20 billion over 2 years. Mm. So that's $10 billion a year, or 10 times as much. This, if the House version came even close to passing, and the House version also has money for after-school suppers for low-income children, and both versions of the bill have, I believe, $150 million for soup kitchens, food cupboards, food banks. So both are good on that, and the Senate does have significant food stamps money, not quite as much as the House. So either version would be better than the status quo. But given the hunger emergency and the food insecurity emergency we have in America, we really need the strongest possible provisions, and that's why we hope we can go with the House provisions. We're extraordinarily thankful that both Senator Casey and Senator Specter, both the senators from Pennsylvania, did vote for the stimulus bill. And I note with some irony that some people from the right are saying they're going to challenge Senator Specter in a primary. I think those are a very, 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 very small, discredited minority of people. The vast majority of Pennsylvanians, like my home state of New Yorkers, are common sense folks who understand that investing in ending hunger is a great way to help our economy, and it's a way to create jobs. So I think Senator Specter and Senator Casey in the long run are going to get a lot of widespread support in the state for efforts to further bolster hunger fighting and economic recovery.
Well, on that note, Joel Berg, I thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. And he's the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. His new book is All You Can Eat, How Hungry is America? We just said goodbye to Pennsylvania State Senator Mike Brubaker, Republican from Lancaster County and co-founder of the Legislative Hunger Caucus. And we also talked with Carrie Morgan. She's director of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Leave us an email. Find out more about the program. Patty Leswing, Devorah Lissick, and Susan Greenbaum produce Radio Times. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the program. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Artie Moscowain, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.